Blog Talk Radio. That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Beiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of the Middle Ground.
Good evening. Good evening to everyone. Welcome to tonight's episode of The Middle Ground. Eric Beiler is still filming tonight. I hope he joins us later on. But for right now, I am your host. I am Lee Beaumont. I am hosting the show from Middletown, New Jersey. Before we get on to tonight's primary topic, which will be knowing how you know, I just want to mention that I voted today. In New Jersey today, there is a special election for senator. You might know that longtime New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg passed away about 2 months ago. Our governor, Governor Christie, rather than appointing a permanent replacement for him, decided to have special elections. So today was the primary. There will be a general election in October, and that will decide who the next senator is for New Jersey. Voted this morning, a little after 10 o'clock this morning, in teeming rain. Turnout was low. Most people don't think to vote in August. Not so many people vote in primaries. The only thing on the ballot was the one senator. But we hope it was representative, and I look forward to hearing what it was. So with that, let's move on to tonight's topic. The topic is knowing how you know. And you might wonder, what is that? And what does that have to do with politics, and what does that have to do with the middle ground? This is a topic I've done a lot of thinking about, and I hope it's interesting to you, and I do believe it's relevant. I hope we can have some good discussion on it. The question is this: how do you decide what to believe? How do you distinguish between fact and opinion? When you hear a claim, how do you assess the reliability of the sources? What do you consider to be a reliable rather than an unreliable information source? And how do you gather and assess evidence for or against some proposition? If a trusted authority supports a particular belief and direct evidence you see disputes that fact, how do you resolve the discrepancy? Are your beliefs well-founded and consistent? It turns out that many people believe whatever they want, and then they select information that seems to confirm what's convenient for them to believe and dismiss contrary or conflicting information. Other people listen to what their friends have to say or follow the opinions of various celebrities. It might be that the group that shouts the loudest and most often or most cleverly gets your attention. Perhaps you're influenced by people in power, listening to what parents and teachers said when you were young, rebelling against them as an adolescent, and then choosing other authority figures to follow as an adult. People are often captivated by attractive, charming, glib, or charismatic people. Mystical language seems to seduce and entrance others. Many of us are members of some tribe which supports its own belief system. This might be a political party, an advocacy group, a professional society, an industry group, a club, a religious or cultural traditions, or proponents of some particular ideology. None of these approaches can accurately distinguish reliable information from rumor, myth, gossip, advertisement, propaganda, or other forms of unreliable, outdated, misleading, untrue, or deceptive misinformation. And because we are most comfortable when we are most certain, regardless of the validity of our beliefs, we naturally avoid or resist exposure to information that threatens our own tenuous certainty. The Supreme Court broadly upholds the First Amendment protection of free speech. Hate speech, misleading information, deliberate lies are all constitutionally protected forms of expression. The Internet welcomes all contributors, and as a result, support for almost any belief, regardless of its truth, is easily found. This constant influx of unverified information makes it essential that we take personal responsibility to decide for ourselves what is reliable, and what is not. You're entitled to your own opinions, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan declares, but you're not entitled to your own facts. This captures the extent and boundaries of tolerance. While tolerance is essential in the realm of opinion, it has no place in the realm of fact, but you need to be able to distinguish fact from opinion to even be tolerant. Facts correspond with reality. Because we all live on the same earth, we all share the same reality, observed through our unique points of view. This is our common ground. This is the middle ground. We need to dig deeply to find that common ground and stand together on the bedrock of reality. Facts establish the middle ground. We can each choose to move toward the political left or the political right, but we each must start from the facts while we constantly stay connected to the facts. Taking responsibility for your own beliefs is not easy, but it is immensely rewarding. When you know how you know, you can be confident in what you know. You can then strive to purify the knowledge stream you accumulate and assimilate. When you know how you know, you can easily identify the fools, fakers, and frauds among us, and confidently dispute, correct, dismiss, or avoid them. Knowing how you know is a big step you can take now to reduce the influence of money and special interests in politics. Because you're less susceptible to misleading, manipulative, deceptive, and unhelpful influences, money spent by special interests on propaganda designed to support only their cause becomes less effective. You know how you make up your own mind based on careful, accurate, nuanced, and balanced assessment of reliable information. Facts are stubborn. When you are justifiably confident in knowing what is true, what is false, and what you are unsure of, you know when to stand firm, when to yield, and when to change your beliefs. So that's my case for knowing how you know and deciding what you believe. Before we go forward with some questions and answers and dialogue that might lead to your own theory of knowledge, as you call it, I use the word theory of knowledge to describe the process you go through to decide to filter out all the onslaught of information that comes at you from rumors and special interests and propaganda and advertisement and disinformation and so on to decide what it is you believe. So with that, why don't we take one caller here? We seem to have a caller from area code 313. Hello, area code 313. Tell us your name, where you're calling from, and what's on your mind.
It's sort of a housekeeping issue. I'm trying to find the this particular broadcast, and I don't have a URL that I can get to. Can I follow this on a website, or must I call in?
You can follow it on a website.
What would that URL be, please?
Well, let's go to blogtalkradio.com, and then blogtalkradio.com, Coffee Party USA.
Oh, great. This is... All right, it's not giving me the right information. All right, so Coffee Party USA, go ahead.
So you're blogtalkradio.com/CoffeePartyUSA.
Right.
Slash 2013.
Hang on. 2013.
Slash 08.
Hold it. I'm sorry. I'm having difficulty getting... Okay, could I have those numbers again, please? Slash what?
The year, 2013.
Got it. Go ahead.
08 is the month.
Go ahead.
14 is the day.
14
is the all slashes. And then, did something come up with that or not?
It's supposed to be 14 or 13. Today is the 13th.
I know that, but it seems to be 14 in the URL, forward-looking group here.
All right. Then it's, so basically, Is there a slash after, a forward slash after the 2013 and after the 08?
Yes.
Sorry. Sorry to be so primitive here, but...
It's okay.
I'm terrible. Go ahead.
What is this? Hang on.
Okay. And that's it?
No. It's long after that. The middle down, it's, tell you what, a better way to do this is to search for Coffee Party Middle Ground, and then whatever URL you get, change the date to 213-08-14. I think that's the fastest way to get on there.
Thank you kindly. I'll chase it down from there.
All right. Good luck with that. Thank
Sorry
you.
About that.
Okay. Okay, so with that housekeeping out of the way, apologize for that. Talking about knowing how you know. So, as we were saying, we are subject every day to news, opinions, analysis, commentary, satire, testimonials, endorsements, threats, conversations, dialogue, rumors, gossip, folklore, traditions, rules, superstitions, taboos, censorship, speculation, predictions, fear-mongering, forecasts, propaganda, advertisements, sales pitches, and much, much more than that. But each of us seems to come out of it saying, I know this is true, I know I believe this, I'm willing to go to political rallies and shout that I know this is true, I'm willing to hold signs and join campaigns and... vote this way and that way, and maybe it's true and maybe it's not. So I've put together some questions you begin asking yourself for developing your own theory of knowledge here. And one of the first one is, how do you assess the reliability, objectivity, and relevance of some particular information source? You can probably find... at least well-dressed information sources on most any topic, on most any opinion, and you've got to make up your mind. And it's difficult to do. You might look at the publication that it's in, and that can give you some idea. Increasingly, our publications are not necessarily in the middle ground. We know cable TV, Fox News is to the right and MSNBC is to the left. I remember when I was a kid in the checkout lines in the supermarket, there used to be a tabloid called the National Enquirer. And they were there in every checkout line, so I presume they sold okay. And they would have stories about space aliens and space babies and my child was kidnapped and taken to Mars and all these kinds of things. And those magazines sold. I wonder whether people believe those sorts of things or not. Probably not the most reliable information source. Even today, many of the news publications or even more general publications lean either to the left or to the right. I'm just trying to recall this from memory, but a study was done on articles in the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal, I had always considered as being a reliable source. It certainly looks well-dressed, well-researched, read by a lot of intelligent people. But I read recently, and I should be able to cite a source for this, but I cannot, so I apologize, that someone surveyed their articles on climate change, on the opinions, and it was definitely biased towards denying or diminishing the risk. So the editors, it seems, are doing something to select articles with some bias in that direction. Surprising, but true. So how do you assess the reliability, objectivity, and relevance of an information source? You might look at who the experts are. Are these experts chosen because they have dedicated their lives to researching these topics, to finding the truth, to sorting through the left-leaning, right-leaning topics, or are these people of convenience? Are they independent of the work being done? Certainly, if you're a paid consultant, you're not independent of the work being done. Certainly, if your research was funded by Big Pharma or Big Oil or whatever, the research might not be unbiased. If you were chosen that day because of a news event, might not be that credible. The word authority is used in two different ways in our language here. A person who has studied the topic for a long time can be an authority based on their expertise in the topic. But there's also positional authority, people who get a job title and therefore have that authority. And we can be caught in the middle of those two things. So how do you assess the reliability, objectivity, and relevance of an information source? It's not easy, but I think it needs to be done in order to come up with a reliable belief. Related to that, how do you evaluate the credibility, reliability, objectivity, and relevance of an expert or authority? Our first question might be, how are you paid? And are there any connections, whether there be monetary or allegiance or reputation or just having been used to this organization, that might cause you to be less than objective? How do you assess the relevance of evidence? Each of us sees the sun rise in the east, go across the sky, and set in the west. Makes it pretty clear that the sun moves across the sky, going around the earth. That belief was prevalent probably for millions of years or thousands of years until in the 1630s, Galileo took out his telescope and he looked at the moons of Jupiter and saw that they certainly go around Jupiter. He saw craters on the moon and saw the kind of the shape of the moon and the way the light reflects on the moon. But perhaps most convincingly, he saw the phases of Venus. Venus, through a telescope, has phases much like the moon. And those are easily explained if the sun is in the center and the planets go around. And they're difficult, if not impossible, to explain on some other plan. So Galileo wrote a book called A Dialogue on Two Chief World Systems, where he had two guests coming to dinner, meeting with a host. One guest was taking the Earth-centric view, the view espoused by the Pope and tradition and religion and so on. And the other was aware of Galileo's findings. Galileo was put under house arrest. Actually, he was threatened with death if he did not recant the information, and that was put to death. He did recant that. He was put under house arrest for even suggesting that the Pope might be wrong on that issue. So even though the evidence to the naked eye is clear that the sun goes around the earth, when you push a little deeper, when you take a more global perspective, when you look at more considerations, not just what do we see with our naked eye, but what do we see when we look at the moons of Jupiter, or the phases of Venus, or the craters on the Earth, you get a different answer. As it turns out, it's not that the sun is the center of the universe and the Earth goes around the sun. It's true the Earth goes around the sun, but the sun is not the center of the universe. It turns out we're on the edge of a galaxy called the Milky Way. So we're not even in the center of that galaxy. And the Milky Way galaxy is one of perhaps billions of galaxies, and it's not even clear that the universe has a center. So looking at direct evidence, the sun rises in the morning, seems pretty convincing. Dig a little deeper, and it's a much more complex story. How do you know what to believe on that? call in, please. The call in number for guests is 646-929-2495. If you'd like me to take your call, just press 1, and I will know you'd like me to take your call, and we can talk about this. We'd be happy to hear your questions and comments. Not only do we look at direct evidence like the sun rising in the east, but we often hear statistics cited in favor of one belief or another. And I'm fond of saying that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And the truth of the matter is that if you are unskilled in the use of statistics, and most of us are, they can give you data selected in certain ways to confirm your belief, whether or not that's what they're pointing out. So I think that when someone uses statistics to bolster their point, it's worthwhile to understand whether that's representative data, whether the sample that they chose represents the larger population, whether the statistics they're quoting are reliable indicators of the conclusion that they're making. There's a joke that a statistician drowned while swimming across a lake that had an average depth of 3 feet, because while that might be true, we know that there's higher and lower and so on. So statistics are very powerful tools. They can help us make very valid conclusions, and they can also be misused. So that's something to take a look at. When empirical evidence contradicts a firmly held ideology, how do you resolve the conflict? There are many ideologies out there. Many religions are based on ideologies. I think that the probably the Tea Party has their own ideology. We hear various economic plans or economic forecasts put forward as ideologies. A fair question to ask is, do you believe that raising taxes increases or decreases revenue? A simple-minded model is, the higher the tax it is, the more revenue you get, because it's a larger percentage of what's being made. But of course, the Laffer curve and supply side economics became popular about 30 some years ago, and many people use that theory or that ideology or some semblance of it to argue that cutting taxes raises revenue. It's probably true that the truth is somewhere in the middle of that, that depending on how high taxes are, whether you're in a growth phase or a contraction phase of the economy, what the dispersion of the taxes is, the regression of the taxes is, the answer will be different on that. It's a very complex analysis. There's not a simple answer to that. But if you hold firmly to the ideology that cutting taxes raises revenue, you might be willing to be selective in the data you look at to bolster that view or refute that view. I see we have another caller in area code 620. Area 620, welcome to the Middle Ground. What is your name and where are you calling from, okay, and what is on your mind?
Hey, this is Jack Golding from Ibbotson, Kansas.
Okay.
Who am I talking to?
My name is Lee, and I'm hosting the Middle Ground tonight. Eric Beiler is busy filming, and we hope he will join us later on tonight.
Okay,
what's on your mind, Jack?
Okay. I want to say this. I'll say this briefly. Let's see. A lot of ideology stinks. say that. I have many ideas for cutting taxes, programs. And I'm a libertarian away. One thing you do is do away with the war on drugs. That's one thing. On the philosophy I have.
On that, by the way, Eric Holder, our Attorney General, took a step in that direction tonight. He didn't actually directly say he's going to do away with the war on drugs.
Do away completely. I mean, I think that half of the do away with private prisons. That's one thing you got to do away with. I think it's going to save a lot of money. With reforming the tax code, and I have a program, four codes, four brackets, okay. All right. Do with all deductions, exemptions, credits and filing status, and make it very simple. The tax code could be reduced from maybe 70,000 pages, what they got now, to maybe 100 or less. And
okay,
do that.
Thank you.
Keep the staff busy with. Revising laws. It's a lot of unnecessary laws. And they go by law by law by law by law. Many unnecessary laws and the tax code to be five, four different categories. Exempt to a $10,000 exemption in the beginning for all filers, $50,000, 5% rate.
Okay, Jack. Thank you for that. I'm going to take it there, and I'm going to just comment on a few things that Jack said here. First off, he talked about. Ideology, I think he said ideology is junk. I happen to believe that empirical data, reliable empirical data, generally trumps an ideology, is the way I would say that, and it almost always does. We have to be careful that even a statement like ideology is junk is very close to an ideology itself. Jack mentioned the war on drugs, and as it turns out today, Eric Holder made an interesting announcement, a rather bold announcement, that's actually relevant to the war on drugs. Basically, what he said is that he's going to ask federal prosecutors not to include information on the amount of drugs seized in various cases, in many drug cases. As it turns out, the mandatory sentencing is tied to the quantity of drugs involved in a case. And if you don't mention the quantity of drugs, it gives the judges more discretion in sentencing. Eric Holder cited the overcrowding in prisons, the cost of all of that, and points out that we're just not a better world for a lot of this. And if the judges can have a little more discretion, that will do it. So that's just interesting that today... Eric Holder made that announcement relevant to the war on drugs. Jack also talked about tax simplification, and I'm sure there is a fruitful area in tax simplification, but I want to draw a distinction between simple and simplistic. We heard Herman Cain tell us about the 999 tax plan. That's certainly simple, but it might be simplistic. Simple is a understanding that reveals the true essence of a particular problem and brings it forward. And we see things like iPhones and iPads that just seem so simple to use because the essence of computing is the screen and what we want to do with it and so on. They remove the excess. They focused on that, and they move us forward. Simplistic, however, is a very close to an ideology that just misses the point and gives us rules that are just too simplistic. We might hear that all you need to know about economics is supply and demand. That would be simplistic rather than simple. 999 tax plan, probably simplistic rather than simple. So I just thought it was worthwhile to bring out that distinction. So, Jack, thank you for calling. Thank you for cautioning us to be wary of ideologies. Thank you for promoting simplicity. And let's be aware that we are revealing the essence when we go to something simple, as opposed to glossing over the complexity of what we might be dealing with, which would be simplistic. So, I hope you're thinking about how you know when you know, how you come to your own beliefs, the rules you might follow to come to a belief, evaluate a source, and so on. So we have a question now. When do you find expert testimony more or less compelling than direct examination of evidence? We see the sky is blue, but as it turns out, there are no blue pigments in the sky. We might wonder the age of the universe. And if we talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's likely to tell us it's 13.78 billion years old. And you say, wow, that's really long. It's kind of mind-boggling. When you study evidence that goes beyond our everyday experience, things like the theory of relativity, which tells us that time slows down as things move faster and makes other predictions that seem counterintuitive. How do you deal with that? So something to keep in mind, and it really goes back to what are you looking at? How could you on an everyday basis assess the age of the universe? It would be very difficult for a layperson to do that. You might think of the oldest person you know or how long is recorded history or these kinds of things, but they're probably just trivial evidence compared to a systematic look at it. And then you look at the evidence and the logic and the rationality that an expert has put together on this. Measuring the age of the universe is extraordinarily difficult. It has taken probably hundreds of years of dedicated effort by some very hardworking people. It has taken the Hubble telescope. It has taken other instrumentation. But a person like Neil deGrasse Tyson can explain it, at least in a way that a lay person can connect the dots. You can look at him and say, I think he wants to get the information here correctly. He has a little bit of a dramatic flair to himself, which I think is fine and doesn't necessarily bias the data. Does he have a vested interest in the outcome? Maybe a little bit. But probably his most vested interest is in the accuracy of it and his willingness to update it. So there's one example where expert testimony might be compelling to you, might even allow you to say, I'm going to go with that even though my everyday experience is different from that. It's a difficult thing to do, but I think it's the right thing to do when it's the right expert and the right topic. Another thing to keep in mind is how do you maintain your objectivity when you're subjected to various forms of influence? We see things directly, we listen, we dialogue, we hear suggestions and recommendations, we get advice from various people, we hear opinions from various people. There's what we learned and what we forgot during our education. There's our prior experience and our existing beliefs. Ideologies are out there. There's what we read, and there's advertisements and indoctrination and propaganda and censorship, counseling, peer pressures, attachment, habits. All of these pressures influence us. And how do we remain objective on that? You might know about the ASH conformity experiments. They took a subject and put him in a room with a handful of Confederates, people who were in on the experiment. And they were shown drawing of some lines of different lengths. And they were asked to choose which is the longer and which was the shorter. And the answer is just clean. It just there in black and white, you can see which one is the longest. But the Confederates were all pointing to a shorter one and saying that it was longer. And a surprising number of people said, well, if you all think that's true, I'll go along with it. So there's a case where peer pressure caused a large number of subjects to dismiss what they saw right in front of them on a fairly objective test and kind of go along with the crowd. So we are broadly subjected to many influences. I use the word propaganda, and that might bring to mind heavy-handed Cold War tactics. But I think that money in politics has brought us propaganda almost every day. When policy groups are funded by special interests, are willing to fund research papers, are willing to present them as if they were objective information, yet they were basically paid people to present some sort of view. That is propaganda. You might say it's free speech. The Supreme Court says it's free speech, but it's also propaganda. And you need to be aware of that. You need to understand that most of what we see and hear is of that ilk to one degree or the other, and you need to sort through it and make up your own mind. Our brains subject us to a long list of cognitive biases. Basically, our brains are designed to convince us that we are okay, and we interpret data to confirm that. I have a list here of cognitive biases that has probably two or three dozen. Ambiguity effect, anchoring and attention bias, availability heuristic, availability cascade, backfire effect, bandwagon effect, base rate fallacy, belief bias, bias blind spot, choice supportive bias, and so on, just to take us through the A's and the B's in the list. This is the way our brains work. I always like the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. That's the way our brains work. All our brains work that way. And there are often forces at work to kind of exploit that, manipulate that, to move us in, to influence us in certain directions. Something we need to be aware of, and we need to take some steps to counteract. How do you maintain your objectivity when subjected to various forms of power? Your boss walks into the office and says, how do you like my necktie? You could say it's the most ugly tie I've ever seen. Or you could say it looks great on your boss. Or you could say, well, it looks very fashionable. And that's kind of a trivial example of where power might influence what you say or do. But there are obviously more sinister examples where a report gets done carefully and objectively and draws a conclusion which is unfortunate for the goals of someone in power. Your boss, his boss, the organization, the funding organization, the political party, the ideology, whatever. Do you stick to your guns and say these are what the facts are, or do you change a few words here and there in the report and move on? These are choices that we face, many of us face, in various organizations and even in small organizations. Many of the reports we might read or hear on the news and elsewhere may have been subjected to that. Bill Moyers did a piece that I thought was very good, talking about the build-up to the Iraq war. And there was, he basically calls the journalists to task for not seeing sooner that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq was not a primary player in the tragedies of 9/11, and so on. And as it turns out, NBC is owned by, I think, is it General Electric? Anyway, it's a large group. There are financial implications of defense contracts, going to war, not going to war, doing politicians favors or not. And he basically alleges in that report that news media, many news media, pulled their punches, did not investigate these weak signals with all the vigor that they might to have uncovered these problems. So power is always out there. It's always pushing in some direction, and it's very easy to yield to the power rather than to speak truth to the power. I think we have another caller here. Area code 620. Who is that, and where are you calling from, and what is on your mind?
Oh, this is me, Jack Golding.
Yes, did you push your button again?
Yeah.
That's still there. We can move on. Okay. Callers can call in, please, on 646-929-2490. We're talking about knowing how you know, how you come to the beliefs that you hold, and whether or not that is a rational process or is haphazard. Do you decide what you want to believe and then come up with reasons to justify it? Or do you suspend your judgment, listen carefully to arguments for and against and in the middle, and evaluate the reliability of the sources, the representative nature of the evidence, and the biases that might be at work, the power that might be there, and so on. Difficult, but I think it's essential in our democracy. One way to tell whether you're onto something here or not is to examine beliefs from a variety of reference frames. We probably all learned Greek mythology in grade school, where Zeus lived on top of Mount Olympus and held court over many other gods, doing all sorts of fantastic things. Those are wonderful stories. They give some sort of an explanation for the sun going across the sky and the seasons occurring and so on and so forth. But how well do those stories hold up? Mount Olympus, I think, is a little more than 10,000 feet. A hardy hiker could probably go to the top of Mount Olympus and see for himself whether or not Zeus is there. So as long as you're willing to stay in the valley and not give a lot of thought to this, you can believe that Zeus is up there pulling the strings. But when you frame up, when you go to a broader reference frame, not just in the valley, but let me go to the top of Mount Olympus and let me go even broader into space, that theory just does not hold up. The ancients talked about four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And that sounds pretty cool. You can see water, you can see air, you can see fire, you can see earth. Looks like what you need to build things. But as you begin examining earth, you can find different types of minerals. So earth itself is not uniform. And as you examine minerals, you'll find out that those are made of different chemical elements. And as you dig deeper into that, as happened during, I think it was the 1800s, they identified, 92 chemical elements, naturally occurring chemical elements, rather than earth, air, fire, and water. So there's a little bit more complexity. When you go into those elements, we learned in probably high school chemistry that they themselves are composed of protons, neutrons, and electrons. So even those are not elemental. And then we know now that those are composed of quarks. So drilling down and going deeper can be a good test. Let's take another caller here. We have a caller from area code 313. Can you tell us what is your name and where you're calling from and what's on your mind?
It's Bob Whitney from Milwaukee, Wisconsin area, southeastern Wisconsin.
Okay.
Thanks for the URL information before. I'm able to listen to it there now. Is there a chat running as well or not?
Let me see.
Because if there's not, I just am not in the right place apparently. In any case, I wanted to congratulate you and give you kudos for your efforts at taking such a big bite as far as the topic. And we're also talking about faith or reason, in my opinion.
Right.
And that issue of faith, once you are dealing with people of faith, reason no longer can be applied. Their belief is more important than any fact you could present or any argument, any rational argument that you can go, because ultimately you're faced with them saying, but I believe thus and so. It doesn't matter whether or not it's the Hindu gods or whether or not it's, the Bible, our Bible, the Western Christian Bible, it's still a matter of what people are willing to believe and what they're willing to not believe. I mean, science in and of itself, is it not also a belief system that you can actually objectify the perception? And then you get into the philosophers who say that perception is all very subjective. Even the folks now talking about multidimensional universes and stuff like that.
Let me tell you, Bob, let me tell you how I think about it. Let me mention a few things. Number one, I am an electrical engineer. So I'm not necessarily a scientist, but it's kind of a scientific background, and I have a bias in that direction. What I believe is that faith has a place. It has a place in extending beyond empirical evidence, but that faith has to yield to empirical evidence. So, for example, here I...
Sorry,
say again?
I stepped on you. Forgive me.
All right. So what I was saying is that faith has a place in extending beyond empirical evidence, but that faith has to yield to empirical evidence where there's a conflict is what I've come to. So here I am having faith that people are listening to this, and I don't have a lot of evidence for it other than in the few calls that we come in here. But I go on and I'm trying to do my best and that kind of a thing. So that's extending beyond empirical evidence, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't have that faith. But when the Pope was faced with his faith in the Earth at the center of the universe and the contradictions that Galileo saw in that, there was direct evidence, empirical evidence, that it was wrong. And at that point, faith, I think, has to yield. That's kind of how I reconcile this. So it's not a strictly either-or. But if you say, if there's empirical evidence, reliable empirical evidence that counters the faith, we've got to go with that. And but faith has its role in pulling this forward. That's the way I think about it. But you wanted to make a, you wanted to continue your comment.
Well, on the spiritual level, if indeed that can be separated out, the idea that one's faith or belief in a system, I mean, isn't it a matter of some degree of faith? And I don't have an answer. I'm not sort of just arguing against the whole thing. But what is this business of empirical evidence? Now, how is that ultimately defined? Because empirical evidence, supposedly, based on all of the scientific evidence we have, is that global warming is real and it is man-made.
Mm-hmm.
That's the empirical evidence. But we have so many people who do not want to believe that because they will not believe the supposedly empirical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
For that matter, let's take it a step further to the anti-evolutionists, people who say the world is only 5,000 years old, what they're about,
mm-hmm.
and that humans rode dinosaurs. To me, that would be almost, give any credence to that is the sort of same kind of credence I'd have to give someone who believed in a pantheistic God where they could, you know, pray to this person or that person, or the, excuse me, that God or this God for a particular desire. I mean, where is the empirical evidence edge? I mean, where is empirical evidence proven? I mean, how do you get someone to accept empirical evidence if the issue of faith overrides them?
It's difficult, and that's why I'm on this topic here. I will tell you that my interest in this topic became much more intense when I learned about the Creationist Museum in Kentucky. It was funded with $25 million in private contributions to build a museum to the concept of creationism. There are models in the back of man coexisting with dinosaurs, and it's just incredible to me that this kind of thing happens. But as I said earlier on here, what the human mind does is, step one, choose a belief based on intuition or convenience or your outcome or something, and then step two, come up with post hoc rationalizations for it. That's what I'm trying to change here. Frailty in our brains, and if we can write down our theory of knowledge, what are the steps that we go through to say what we believe, I think it's a great step forward.
I would agree. How about coming up with some basic tenets as to why to believe in empirical evidence? What is there about empirical evidence that why should we believe, or why should someone believe? Or for that matter, we need to define the empiricism of the evidence.
Right.
What does that mean?
It is tricky. Let me tell you that while there's not a chat box on the page, and I apologize for that, you'll see a comment by me with a URL. Take a look at it, and I'll give the URL there, which is... which is in depth on this, and I've worked on this topic for many years, and I've gone there and looked at empirical evidence. What are the dangers of that? What is representative? How can that be misused? What are some of the biases we have in it, and so on and so forth. So I hope that can be helpful to you. So thank you, Bob, for that. I appreciate your interest in the topic. Our faith and empirical evidence. Contradictory. I think there's a role for each. As again, you need faith to extend beyond where there's empirical evidence, because it's not always there. It's difficult to interpret. But when there is clear empirical evidence that contradicts the faith, I think you've got to yield to it. But again, it's difficult. Thank you very much. And I'm going to go on here to area code 908. Area code 908. Welcome to the middle ground. Tell us your name, what you're calling from, and what's on your mind.
Hello, this is Chad Lang calling from New Jersey. It's an interesting topic. I was hesitant to call because I don't normally talk about this in public. That sounds awful. But I looked at the link that you put up, deciding what to believe, and I have a problem with just that statement, deciding what to believe. I consider myself, well, I'm not an engineer like yourself, but I do trust engineers' opinions and architects' opinions, and where I'm headed here is 9/11. And I know, you know, I watch C-SPAN and be disappointed that every time someone brings this up, they divert the thing and say, we're not talking about that, nobody will talk about it. And yet we all saw this thing happen 10 years, 12 years ago, and we know what we saw. And the more we saw it, and the more we saw it, we were thinking, and even the newscasters and everything says, it's impossible. How could this happen? Well, there is so much empirical evidence now all over the world about what happened, and yet everything in our world has changed because of this event.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at the evidence that, you know, when you're talking about empirical evidence, I thought we were a country that believed in education. So if a man says he's a doctor and he went through a medical school, I trust that when he opens my belly and takes my gallbladder out, that he knows what he's doing. Not that he believes what he's doing, but he knows what he's doing. And if I go into a building, an architect designed, and the building supervisor or building codes approved, I want to trust the fact that it will not fall down. Now, we live in such a bubble in the United States that we think we have all the answers to everything. If people would go to Canadians for 9/11 Truth, if they would go to the conference that happened in December, I think it was October of last year, and hear what really fine minds and scientists and engineers have to say about what happened and what could happen, and just think about it. I mean, this is almost common sense, but at the same time, I would yield to an engineer's knowledge. I mean, you people are trained to know how a building goes up, to how steel frame buildings are built, what's going to bring them down, what's going to keep them up. Why should we not trust that? And all of a sudden we're trusting, I mean, everything in our world has changed since 9/11. And I've been to parties, I don't mention this anymore because my wife told me not to do it, but for a while I'd go to dinner parties and things like that, and I'd say to people, I'd start this, and my wife gave me a dirty look, and I said, okay, let me just say one thing, Building 7. Everybody I've talked to doesn't know what I'm talking about, Building 7. At 5:20 on 9/11, Building 7, the 47-story building, fell down on its own footprint in 11 seconds. We never hit one airplane. There was no fuel in it, nothing. How did that happen?
Yeah, I think that was the Deutsche Bank was in there.
Well, Deutsche Bank was there. What's his name? Giuliani's bunker was in there. There was a whole investigative things, and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not really going into conspiracy theory. I'm not going into the who, what, when, but the how. How did these buildings fall? Everybody said at the time, looks like a controlled explosion, a demolition.
Yeah.
That we're all familiar with. We've seen them in Philadelphia. Right. We've seen them on the news. They have them in Las Vegas. We've seen all these things. This thing fell exactly like that. One of the most interesting points that came up in the Canadian thing that one of the investigators commented on is since 9/11, how have the building codes in New York City changed? Has anybody investigated, have the building codes changed? If those buildings are designed to fall that way, then every building we go into New York has the potential to fall that way, to come right down on its own footprint. That would make me a little nervous. So I would want to know about building codes. But anyway, my point is, I mean, for me, I've had a tough time believing in coffee party, believing in almost anything in the last 11 years because of this event.
Let me just comment on that a little bit. First off, I live in Middletown, New Jersey. If you go just to the North Shore, a few miles from my house, you can see across to now the Freedom Tower.
Mm-hmm.
37 residents of Middletown were killed on that day because many of the people commute into New York. So it's a real event.
It
collapsed on TV,
real event.
and I gasped. I just couldn't believe that could happen.
There
is a good NOVA program. I do like NOVA. I think that they're trying to get at the truth and trying to be objective, where NOVA showed basically a committee of civil engineers who looked at slow motion or the best video available of the collapse and tried to understand what actually happened. And I can only address the Twin Towers with my comment. Your comments on building number 7, I haven't really thought through, but the Twin Towers were built with a novel design where much of the weight was held on the exterior frame
mm-hmm.
of the building.
Right, the netting.
Just the design
mm-hmm.
of the elevators, just to get a design
right.
of elevators to go up, it had to be novel, so it didn't take up the whole thing. And something
mm-hmm.
about that, and they actually, you can see the engineers looking at this view to see whether it was the inside collapsed first or the outside collapsed first, to see what happened. And I think that these were sincere people who studied long and hard, knew what they were doing, looked at it, and concluded that you know, it collapsed because the planes hit it, and that the temperature actually got to a temperature that could melt steel, which is kind of unbelievable. It did happen. Building 7, I don't know as much about. I asked you whether Deutsche Bank is in there. I just happen to have a friend who works for Deutsche Bank and had to commute upstate for many months while that was rebuilt. I have not studied that in depth. I am cautious with conspiracy theories. I'm going to bring out another concept called unfalsifiable claims. If someone makes an unfalsifiable claim, I will tell you that I saw Elvis in the mall yesterday. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's basically
mm-hmm.
an unfalsifiable claim. There's no question you could ask me or no proof you could ask for that would dispute that. Okay, you can say, what did he look like? I said,
right.
Well, you've seen Elvis, you know.
mm-hmm.
What did you talk about? Well, we talked about the weather, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, I can always answer those kinds of things.
Right.
So when there's an unfalsifiable claim, the rule that I've come to is extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that the burden of proof, if I'm telling you that I saw Elvis in the mall last night, that's an extraordinary claim. The burden of proof is on me, and that if I don't meet that burden of proof, kind of dismiss the claim. So that's where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Many conspiracy theories rely on unfalsifiable claims, and once you're into that territory, you can speculate forever because there is no empirical evidence you can bring to bear about that. So
right, but what
I
about,
get my...
What about architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, pilots for 9/11 truth, firefighters for 9/11 truth? What do any of these people have to gain from putting their reputations, a lot of them their family life, their social life, at risk by taking this approach that saying, I mean, this is not falsified evidence, as you just said. If you,
right.
you know how to build a building cannot fall at whatever those stories were, at free fall speed, 11 seconds, and with floors underneath it, what pulverized the floors? What, I mean, it was dust. It was nothing but dust. These were enormous buildings with steel and concrete. What could turn them to dust? There was a show on TV called Mythbusters, which I don't know, I think it's on anymore. And you could write in and say, I want to see what, you know, how they did this on this movie or whatever. After 9/11, people wrote in and said, can you do some kind of simulation to show us this pancaking thing?
Right.
They literally said, do not ask this question. We are not going there at all.
Huh.
There's been such a I don't know if there's a word for it, but there's been an app just like C-SPAN does this. They deflect everything. This is not
right.
something we can discuss. And I'm wondering if
preemptive
any of
dismissal.
This, yeah, preemptive dismissal is as bad as the other thing you used with Elvis. I mean,
right.
just because we've got an entire country that thinks they believe this doesn't mean that they're right. And
right,
the
but the other side
of
that is you know, if Mythbusters is dismissing that preemptively because they're part of the conspiracy, I don't know how you can pull off a conspiracy that big either. So that's
No. But the danger here is the word conspiracy. It immediately,
yeah.
especially in our country, immediately says, "Oh, you're a jerk. You're a fool.
Right.
You know, you believe in whatever Star Wars or whatever. You know, what is this? This isn't a theory. This is something. Certainly, as an engineer, when you build something, you must have some protocol as you build it to have an anticipation of what could happen
right.
in the course of building or unbuilding.
And I actually
and yet,
heard in case of the Twin Towers, I actually heard that it was specifically designed to withstand the impact of a 707 airplane, but these airplanes were bigger than that. So they actually considered the scenario of being hit by a plane, and at the time they were designed, a 707 was one of the larger planes.
So it was actually designed to be hit by three planes.
Okay.
Of a 707, but three planes. So this is only one plane. But again, the danger here, the danger of the conversation here, is everybody says, well, then who did it? The theorists or the architects and engineers are not trying to point a finger at anybody.
Right. They're just saying that what they see doesn't meet the facts.
What
they
see doesn't pass the test. And really, you can go to Canadians for 9/11 Truth and you see an incredible list of websites. And I recommend everybody to go to search for Canadian Truth and go to the thing that happened in October where people, scientists, engineers from all over the world convened in Toronto to discuss the evidence of what we saw with our own eyes on 9/11 and basically say that it can't have happened. What happened, what we saw, didn't happen the way we were told it happened.
Right.
And here's the point, my point about it. If that's true, I mean, I kind of in a way think after all these years, the truth is irrelevant. And I'm wondering, the thing that I mull over in my mind, when does the truth become irrelevant? I mean,
I read the 9/11 Commission report. I read it cover to cover. I thought it was pretty good. It made a lot of recommendations. I think that they were conscientious fact factors. I don't remember that they went into in depth in what you're talking about. I don't recall them doing
that.
Well,
they didn't mention Building 7 at all. And how odd that 5:20 that same afternoon, a building one block away from the complex, which was part of the World Trade Center complex, fell down on its own footprint in 11 seconds.
Yeah.
Never hit by a plane.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate that thought. I'll probably go look at Canadians for Truth, but I'm still kind of going with the mainstream story on this, but maybe I'll be swayed.
I understand. I absolutely totally understand. This will be the last time I say anything publicly.
All right. Thank you very much.
I don't want to be ostracized.
All right. And now we have area code 518. Area code 518, can you tell us your name and where you're calling from and what's on your mind?
Sure. Joe Pomponio. I'm calling from Albany, New York. I'm a little north of where you are. This is a rather fascinating show tonight. I went to the website so I could get a better grip on, knowing how to know. If I can step away from belief and just deal with knowledge and understanding. As you explained earlier, what I've read here, some of the things on this website is what I do. I guess that's because back in the day when I was in junior high school, I kind of liked journalism. And who, what, where, when, why, how sticks with me always. What I found in my life, I'm an old guy, what I found in my life is if I encounter things that I don't agree with, and I mean strongly don't agree with. In my younger years, I would fight. I was a real harsh debater. What I learned from that is I couldn't get understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I came around it is by questioning.
Mm-hmm.
And when I question people, you find they may or may not have more knowledge of what they're talking about. You kind of touched on religion. I leave religious discussions for people of religious belief. It's not a part of my life that if I'm in an intellectual conversation, per se discussing NSA or discussing the Iraq War or discussing voter rights. That doesn't come into my being. It put the facts at hand. And I tend to get a little upset, I guess, with the right and the left, especially now. Things are getting really crazy. They passed voter rights laws in North Carolina. They're not good laws, okay? But they are laws. We have to deal with them. And what I'm not seeing, okay, you're going to take legal action. This is going to take time. Where's the plan to get these people registered anyway?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to march on something, why not get them some buses, get them the applications, get them the information they need so they can be registered? I mean, you know, maybe they can't do it. I don't live in North Carolina, but this is the kind of reasoning I use. Yeah, perhaps somebody's doing something wrong, or perhaps they're doing something right. All right? But you have to look at all the information you can get on it. I'm not
right.
even going
to And, Joe, just a couple of things. You talk about, you know, asking questions, and that's absolutely critical. That's the skill we want. It's becoming more difficult because some of these positions, even especially the extreme positions, especially the positions that defend an ideology, come with their own talking points. How long can you hold a discussion on the Second Amendment without somebody blurting out, if guns are outlawed, only outlaws have guns? It turns out that's might be true, but it's kind of irrelevant to the thing. So the ideologies are protected by talking points that refute the common questions, which makes it even that much more difficult. And what will happen is you'll be kind of put off by that. And then what happens to me is I'm kind of put off by those, and then the next day it occurs to me that I was kind of bamboozled, and by then it's kind of too late. You talked about not speaking about religion, and I was brought up, told in polite company you don't discuss religion or politics. I think it's a damn shame. I think at least discussing politics, and that's what we're doing here on tonight's show, of course, discussing politics is vitally important. Strong democracy requires informed citizens, and you can't have informed citizens unless you can dialogue on these issues. And it's a shame that we cannot have more civil dialogue on these issues. And I try to do it, and I get in a lot of trouble for it, but I try to do it as a way to hone my skills in the topic we're talking about here and the questions you're talking about asking and so on and so forth. One little technique that I've learned, it's a little bit sarcastic, but if somebody tells you something that's kind of incredible, and you have to get the emphasis right, but if you just say really, and if you strike the balance between really in terms of a exclamation and really in terms of a question,
yeah.
You can maybe give a little pause. So that's something. Another technique I learned is that if you're addressing a group, there will be people on the hard right, people on the hard left, and people kind of sitting on the fence. If you can sway the fence sitters, you've done your job. So if you can give a coherent enough argument, cast enough doubt, ask enough good questions, present enough reliable evidence, that the fence sitters move, you're probably in pretty good shape. The people who are on the hard left and right have their talking points ready and are defend against this and probably won't move. So those are a couple of points on that.
You brought up the talking points. Apparently, what I've discovered, because I'm starting to become a town hall freak up here in Albany, and I try to go to town halls. You try to discuss things with adversaries, be they hard right or hard left. Now, I will give the left a little credit. They will let you listen. They've got their talking points. When I go to the hard right, they don't even want to know me. If you're not a supporter, I'm involved in fracking up here in upstate New York.
Right.
And they have a website that you can go to for the truth about fracking. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they'll only let you in the website if you support them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want it. Hear, questions about safety or anything, anybody. The only people they want to talk to are people that agree with them.
And by the way, that's a pretty good indication that it's not reliable information, right? That should be throwing up red flags all over the place. On fracking, the questions that I ask are a couple of them. Why do you need the Halliburton loophole would be the first question. If this is safe, why do you need the Halliburton loophole would be the first one. The other question related to that is, I'm not against energy, I'm not against jobs, but I would like you to list for me all of the externalities of fracking. What are all the costs of fracking that are not necessarily borne by the fracking operator? And we know that there's wastewater, possible water contamination. We know that there might be seismic activity. We know that there methane, might be methane leaks and many other things. And if you can begin with list all the externalities, that's a fairly objective exercise. Once you have that list of externalities, then what I like to do is say, when these are addressed, when the cost of those externalities is handled, and I believe they have to be handled by the drill operator.
Yeah.
When those are handled, then we can move on. Don't tell me that it's jobs or not. There is so much gas here. There is so much money to be had that it can be done in a safe way, in a careful way, in a way that pays for all the externalities, and then we've got something to move forward. So I'm not against fracking. I'm against you doing it with other people's money, which is what you're doing when you ignore those externalities.
Well, it's another area they won't discuss, and this goes to the Keystone Pipeline also. Where's the liability, okay, if something goes wrong? What happens here is a independent fracking company is doing the gas collection, or they're trying to. We got a ban on it. But they will collect the gas for a gas company. Now, if something goes wrong, it's like that train wreck up in Canada. They just go bankrupt. And, you know, any damage that's done, you're out of luck. You know, if there were a way to collect, they have yet another way out.
Yeah.
I had made a comment a couple of years ago. Well, if this is so safe, get insurance. So if something goes wrong, you have an insurance policy. And the bottom line is no one will insure it.
Right, right. Yeah. That's clever. I think insurance costs is a good way to evaluate the market value or some expert assessment of the risks involved. So that's a good remedy.
But, you know, Laz, to get back, I guess, to the actual goal, this, what is it, Wikiversity.
Okay? Wikiversity, yes.
Wikiversity is rather challenging, and it's laid out like an assignment. I might play with this.
It's a course. Yeah. I wrote it, by the way.
Oh, excellent.
You'll see my name if you'll see, yeah. I wrote it. You'll see it attributed to L. Beaumont, which is me, Lee Beaumont. So I did develop this. I spent some time on it. I hope it's useful. Wikiversity, everybody knows Wikipedia, of course. Wikiversity is a sister project where their goal is to develop courseware by volunteer editors, and this is one of the courses that I've done to do that. It's an assignment because learning happens when your brain thinks, not when I'm talking. So that's why it's kind of an assignment. And this the course form of this came out from a dialogue that Eric Beider and I have had over the past couple of months where I challenged him. I said, I would like every Coffee Party member to write down their theory of knowledge. And whenever I say that, my wife's eyes glaze over and his eyes glaze over. And he said, that's too hard. People don't know what you're talking about. Try to break it down into a number of questions. So the template that we have here, the questions I've been asking are kind of the questions I came up with that. And you'll see the Anacostia question in there has a dozen different questions, and then it has some study materials for it. But I hope you'll give this some thought. I hope that you'll maybe pay attention to how do you come to your own beliefs, and is it a repeatable process, and is it reliable, and is it rational? What does it take for you to change your mind? Because I think this is a skill we're all going to learn. With the Internet unleashing all kinds of stuff out there, it's probably one of the most important skills you can have. If you will fall for anything, you can go anywhere on the Internet, and you're just going to be thrashing around. Your beliefs will be swinging here, there, and everywhere, or you're going to be picking and choosing. But you're not going to be focusing on what is the real truth, what can I believe here. And part of the solution is to be willing to say, I don't know, or I am unsure. If you look at the diagram that's on the first page of the site there, I classify things as true, false, and unsure, and many, many things are unsure. And it's not wimpy or indecisive or poor leadership to say you're unsure of something. Very often it's simply where you are on these things, and it's kind of a bold move, and you can explain why you are unsure, what the evidence is for it, what the evidence is against it, what the unknowns are, and move on from there. It's much better to say I'm unsure about this than to make up an answer and assert it, which happens just too often.
Well, when you're unsure, you search. You ask questions,
right,
and you evaluate it, or you give up on it and move on to something else. In my case, it'd be, you know, how important is it to me?
Right.
You know, if it's something, you know, that I'm like a dog with a bone with, I won't quit. But if it's just something that, you know, well, is this car better than that car when I go to make a purchase? You know, I'm not really going to get that analytical about it.
Right.
Whereas, you know, where, you know, I guess the human race is concerned, and, you know, there could be damage or a mishap to, you know, my fellow citizens, people on the planet, I'm liable to pay a lot more attention and at least, you know, have a better understanding of what I'm talking about.
All right. Thank you very much, Joe. Thanks for your call. And I want to go on to one more question I have in the template here. And that is, how do you maintain your objectivity when a compelling narrative depends on incredible beliefs? So Chad's probing of the 9/11 story, you know, the story is what we've been told. The planes hit, the buildings collapsed, and so on. He believes that story involves an incredible belief that a building can collapse that quickly, that compactly, and in the case of Building 7, that remotely from the impact. But what happens is the human brain is wired for story. We love a story, and as soon as a narrative can connect the dots and the facts, we tend to buy it. I talked about Zeus on the top of Mount Olympus. Those are fascinating stories, the myths. But they put together some pretty silly facts, yet they endure. I'll tell you just briefly my own belief in Santa Claus. And excuse me for using a religious example here, but I think Santa Claus is well known. When I was first let me begin that my parents went to great lengths to preserve the Santa Claus myth for us when we were kids. And it was a wonderful thing that they did, and we really enjoyed it. But about the time I was in, say, first or second grade, around first grade, I actually kind of approached the Santa Claus story a little bit as an engineering problem, okay? How does he fit down the chimney? How does he know what gifts to get? Where do all these gifts come from? How does the sleigh fly? How does he get from house to house? If he stops and eats milk and cookies at my house, just do the calculation on that. It takes him 10 minutes to do the milk and cookies. There's an awful lot of people in the world. It's not going to work. So I was beginning to have those doubts. But when I was in second grade, my parents, 9 or 10 at night, is going to sleep. They said, look out the window. And I looked out the window, and sure enough, at the end of the driveway, Santa Claus was there in the Santa Claus suit with the boots and so on and so forth. And there it was. The story was reinforced until I found out that was my Aunt Dot entertaining her grandchildren around the corner and came by to see us. But what happens is our brains are wired for story. If selected facts can be strung together into a compelling narrative, it has immense power. And our brains will allow us to dismiss factual inconsistencies if it supports the story. The Santa Claus story is an extreme case. Not everyone's an engineer in first grade, but it doesn't take much to refute the thing. But once the narrative's in place, it's very powerful. And very often there is a contest to take some fact that's kind of undeniable and then weave your story around it before the other guy weaves his story around it, both picking up the same selective facts and going forward with some power there. So beware of that. We talked about non-falsifiable claims. Russell's famous teapot. guy named Russell wrote that if he claims a teapot orbits the sun somewhere in space between Earth and Mars, it's nonsensical for him to expect others to believe him on the grounds that they cannot prove him wrong. So that's an example of a silly, non-falsifiable claim. Beware of non-falsifiable claims. Pay attention to where the burden of proof is. If someone says to you, yes, but you can't prove me wrong, walk the other way. Because I think they hold the burden of proof, not you. And this is the basis for an awful lot of fantasy that goes on these days. So that's something to keep an eye on. We talked about assessing your belief as unsure rather than strictly true or false. Truth is very difficult. Unsure has its role, and it doesn't mean that you're uninformed or not thoughtful or ignorant. It might mean that you're really assessing the facts fairly. What does it take for you to change your mind? A question, if you're engaging perhaps in a political dialogue with someone who is perhaps ideologically driven or who perhaps holds the polarized view from yours, it might be fair to start the conversation by saying, is there anything I could say or do? Is there any evidence I could show you that would change your mind? And if the answer to that question is no, don't engage. Don't go into the dialogue, because if the person has made up their mind and if they have said there's nothing you can say or do to change it, right there is all the evidence you need to know that it's going to be a waste of time. These people are called non-skeptics, and there are many of them. Perhaps we all have some issue on which we are non-skeptics ourselves, but it's a dangerous thing, and we need to look out for it. How do you distinguish well-founded beliefs from assumptions, rumors, myths, and opinions? It's difficult. That's kind of the crux of what we talk about here. So I hope this topic is interesting to you. I hope it has at least spurred some interest in thinking about this. I would be thrilled for you to click on the link on the site here, take a look at the Wikiversity course that I've put together on this. If you have comments or whatever on the course, there's a way to get in touch with me on that. If you go through this and learn from it, that's terrific. If you actually write your own theory of knowledge, that's fantastic, because I'm keeping a gallery of them. Mine is out there. It's kind of lengthy. It includes tutorial examples and explanatory examples and those kinds of things. But it's out there, and I hope it's helpful. With that, we are just about out of time here. So unless we have another caller, and I don't see any, I think we're going to go and wrap this up. So I hope tonight's episode was helpful and interesting, and we're on every Tuesday night at 8 p.m., the Middle Ground, trying to find common ground between the left and the right poles, trying to avoid the false dichotomy of yes or no, true or false, left or right, trying to get at the greater truth in between. So thank you for joining the Middle Ground, and good night.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on the Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard. We'll be right back.